All right.
All right. So Shane, what are some reasons you...
Hang on. I got this.
Okay.
Live from the Mundangerous Meditation Room in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 164 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're returning to Eberron to talk about playing Kalashtar. But first, the Rogue Traders make dinner plans in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Mind Hunter tracks body and soul in the Character Creation Forge. So, Total Party Thrill is brought to you by Kobold Press. Kobold Press has the Creature Codex, which brings you nearly 400 new foes for 5th edition, everything from acid ants to zombie lords. Maybe some Rob zombie lords? Those would be fun. Oh, I would fight those.
Some white zombie? R.I.P. I guess they're not dead, they just quit.
D&D is basically about letting the bodies hit the floor.
That's different, that's Drowning Pool.
It's also Rob Zombie. There are a dozen new demons and 5 new angels, wasteland dragons, and dinosaurs. All new golems, including the Altar Flame Golem, the Doom Golem, and the Keg Golem.
Wait, can I just be clear here? Rob Zombie is not a member of Drowning Pool.
No, but he had that song that was Let the Bodies Hit the Floor.
That was Drowning Pool.
Then Rob Zombie did a version of it.
In what, 2000?
How about this? Wait. Look, I don't want to get into this. D&D is basically about being more human than human.
Oh, okay,
We could take it.
All right, the good folks at Kobold Press are paying us to actually read this, so...
eventually.
You can also find elemental lords, animal lords to challenge powerful parties. You can get chieftains and other leaders for rat folk, for centaurs, for goblins, trollkin, and more.
Why is it that it's trollkin but not troll folk? Why not ratkin or goblin folk?
Oh, it's because rat folk are elevated rats, but trollkin are just like trolls and affiliated races, right? So like rats exist and rat folk implies they're like humanized rats.
Oh, so trollkin are troll adjacent.
Exactly. Yeah. Like they would be goblin kin if that didn't sound stupid. We call them goblinoids instead.
All right, good job, Kobold Press. All right, you've got new undead, including a Hierophant Lich to menace lower-level characters. You know, high-level liches can menace lower-level characters, too.
Yeah, it's just less fun for the characters. this gives them a chance of being successful against that lich. So the Creature Codex was also designed by one James Intricasso of Don't Split the Podcast Network fame.
Yeah, you can use these monsters in your favorite published setting, like Eberron, for example, or you can populate the dungeons in a world of your own creation. So pick up the Creature Codex on the Kobold Press website, link in the show notes, and surprise your players with monsters they will not be expecting.
And once again, Rob Zombie, not a member of Drowning Pool.
Speaking of drowning, floundering perhaps, not really knowing where to go or what to do, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So, the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40k Rogue Trader game played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the lush and fertile world of Malajakt, the Rogue Traders and the survivors of their two best companies of armsmen are relaxing in the Verza House, the beautiful fortress manor of Lord Harlock. And they are kicking it on its grounds some few thousand years prior to the desperate defense of its abandoned shell.
Oh yeah, we're like kicking back... relaxing, all cool. It's disconcerting though, because I mean 10 minutes ago the whole world was dead. Why is it not now? I mean, don't get me wrong, this is better, but it's not gonna last.
Oh well, it's no, obviously it's not gonna last, because eventually this world will be exterminatist and destroyed.
And but perhaps by our actions.
As you walk the grounds with Harlock and his attendant Jack, he basically confirms that for you, that yes, you are not in the 41st millennium anymore, nor are you the first group to make such a journey. In fact, your quarry, the fallen Dark Angel Lord Cypher, has made the same visit himself.
And probably to much better effect, because much to our display, Harlech turns the conversation a bit heretical, explaining that, according to him anyway, there are forces in the galaxy stronger than the Emperor who weave fate and time to their intentions. You know, just saying that, Shane, it makes me think you're going to give my character corruption for out of character talk.
Well, your character's getting insanity for saying display instead of dismay.
Oh, look, I've had a few drinks. It's fine.
Yeah, and of course, you know, this heretical talk of greater forces and manipulation of fate and time and, you know, all of these other things, this is pretty disturbing to the rogue traders. And they do, like, at this point, you guys ask Harlech, like, you talk about this stuff. You talk about fate and time and manipulation and that power, but do you know what's going to happen to Malajak? Like, it doesn't turn out well. And he's like, yeah, no, I do. Like, the planet's going to be destroyed. All of the people here, including myself, will be killed or hopelessly mutated. And the only thing that's going to remain here is basically my fortress, which will be my legacy. And all of my subjects and myself will be fated to protect it from any visitors who approach.
You know, he seems like a pretty faithful servant of the Emperor, except for that, you know, minor heretical stuff that he said a little while ago. Doesn't seem like all that bad a guy. Oh, wait, the corruption has already begun. Look at me.
You guys really do implore him, though. Like, you made multiple good runs at sort of testing his philosophy, and he is just too fatalistic. Like, you're right, though. He is sort of heretical, but it's also kind of coming from a weird place of, like, you know, it's not explicitly that the Emperor doesn't protect. It's just that this is the path that he has to follow.
Right. It's not that the Emperor doesn't protect. It's that the Emperor didn't protect in this particular instance, and he knows that because people keep coming back from the future to say that bad things happen.
Right. Exactly. So he's got this sort of broader than human view, I suppose, or at least broader than Imperial human view, that, like, there is a reason for this, and I have to play my part.
All right, so we can't convince Harlech to do anything differently or to try to avoid this fate for the entire planet and himself, but we can sit down to a really nice dinner. So we do.
Yeah, and rather than wasting time trying to convince him, you decide to learn something useful, particularly about your quarry, Lord Cypher.
And we'll find out what we learn next week.
So this week, we are talking about how to play Kalishtar. Now, Kalishtar are one of the races that were created for the Eberron campaign setting, which means they are now part of the 5th edition Eberron material provided in Wayfinder's Guide to Eberron.
Yeah, look at us. We've got rules and stuff now.
Yeah, real rules, so we can talk about them like adults. So, Ishan, I haven't read Wayfinders. Tell me about the Kalishtar. Who are they? What do they do? Why do I care about them?
Okay, just to clarify, Shane, you have read Wayfinders, but I think you are speaking from the hypothetical perspective of a person who is not.
Yes. Also, I literally have not read that section of Wayfinders, though.
Okay. Where you just skipped to the mechanics. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I mean, their background didn't change. It's fine. Okay. So aside from Warforged, this is the first race that we've covered that are so closely tied to a single campaign setting. So in Eberron, Kalishtar are a psionically powerful race formed from the union of humans and spirits from the plane of dreams. Some of you may know that's called Dalkor. So Kalishtar look almost like humans, but, you know, as these races kind of do, they're a little more attractive and they're a little bit taller. They tend to have this calm, controlled presence about them. And their dual-natured soul causes conflict within them because they see flashes of the immortal spirit's life that occurred before the bonding. So they're these strange scenes from the land of dreams, whether that's imagined horrors or amazing wonders.
Yeah, and Kalishtar are from the mountainous fortress refuge of Adar on the continent Sarlona, which isn't a well-covered place in Eberron. There's a big kind of open space there, But in Corvair, where most games take place, they live in small communities sort of dotted across the five nations.
Yeah, we actually didn't talk about Sarlona all that much when we covered the Eberron campaign setting. It is super cool. It's just there's so much in Corvair, and Wayfinders actually barely touches on Sarlona. So I'm probably one of these days we'll talk a lot more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Kalishtar first appeared, like Shane said, in the original Eberron campaign setting in 2004. They were mostly unchanged in 4E, also in the Eberron campaign setting.
Yeah, and now they're in the Wayfinder's Guide playtest, which will ultimately be the final Wayfinder's Guide, probably unchanged.
All right, so unlike something like goblins or orcs, Kalishtar, because they specifically come from Eberron, even though, you know, they can be ported over, they have a like very detailed racial and cultural history that's very specific to Eberron. So the Kalishtar are human mortal vessels for immortal spirits from Dalkor, the Plane of Dreams. Right now, the essence of that plane, called Il-Lashtavar, or the Dreaming Dark, which is something you may have heard because Keith Baker wrote a series of novels about it, it's an evil and corrupt entity, as are most of the spirits who inhabit that plane. So a few thousand years ago, there was a small band of rebel spirits, led by Teratai, who escaped through the dreams of mortals, and for years they hopped through the minds of sleeping dragons and giants and elves, and they finally came across a community of monks in Adar, in Sarlona, who agreed to permanently bond their souls together with the spirits so that they could stay safely in the material plane, and these became the first Kalishtar.
So, as these monks had children, their spirits were spread across, like, descendants, and kind of split. These descendants have formed family lines from the original, and there are 67 of those spirits.
But in the millennia since, the Dreaming Dark has been pursuing them. Il-Lashtavar manipulated the dreams of the leaders of Sarlona and threw it into civil war. Then, they spent generations creating human vessels for them to possess, called the Inspired, which are a bit like Kalishtar, except that there's no bonding, they just possess these people. And now the Inspired serve as leaders of the Nation of Rhaegia, which basically covers all of the continent of Sarlona. It's an authoritarian state that keeps the entire population under low-level mind control. So Rhaegian assassins hunted down and killed every single descendant of Teratai, which means her spirit is now lost. The rest of the Kalishtar and Eberron are fighting a constant struggle against Il-Lashtavar and the puppet nation Rhaedra, which has the sole goal of killing every single member of the species.
So, to throw this into the kind of macro context of Eberron, right? Like, you have all the human nations on Corvair that are fighting each other for the throne. The Day of Mourning happens. At the same time, there's sort of this shadow war going on in the communities of Kalishtar against these Rhaedran assassins that are pursuing them. The Day of Mourning happens. That doesn't stop the assassins at all. that's still a problem that's gonna affect the Kalishtar and may even create incidents that bubble up to like the national level in Corvair on its own.
Yeah, totally. We've talked before. One of the things we love about Eberron is so many things are happening, and you can incorporate so many different storylines into your game. Like the Mourning is a big deal. But you can have an Eberron game that has nothing to do with the Day of Mourning. You know, you could be dealing with dragons in Arganessen, giants in Zendrick, or this entire other continent of people who are basically being mind controlled and led by these people who have been possessed by spirits from the Land of Dreams. The way it ties into Kalishtar is that Rhaedra is not an allied nation with the nations of Corvair, but Rhaegia did offer a lot of like monetary assistance during the last war to many different nations. So every nation has a Rhaegian ambassador and like an enclave of people from Rhaedra who the Kalishtar and Corvair know are secret assassins who are trying to mind control entire populations of people. Nobody else knows that though.
So they're basically the Swiss.
Yes, that's right. I'm sure all Kalishtar are required to own firearms or wands.
I suppose it's actually more like America in World War One, right?
No, I like the Swiss analogy. No, we are simply humble Kalishtar who make chocolate. I have. Well, would you like a clock?
Humble Rhaedrans. So hackneyed comparisons to European ethnocentrism aside, in true Tolkien fashion, what are some reasons to play Kalishtar?
Well, like we just said, you're facing an entire nation as a small community of refugees. So maybe you like playing the underdog. No matter the plot of the Eberron campaign that you're playing, the Dreaming Dark still wants to kill you. It's always there in the background. It's also possible that you want to take the fight to them. Like, maybe you just want a built-in goal for your character. So the Kalishtar fight the Dreaming Dark either by confronting it directly in combat. You know, maybe that's part of the game. You know, you're fighting agents of the Dreaming Dark specifically. Or they also combat it by living and meditating on, you know, order and justice. Because their religion, the Path of Light, says that this kind of meditation eventually brings about this revolution in the plane of dreams, which destroys the Dreaming Dark and actually all of the Kalishtar as well, and creates a new, better essence for the plane. Now, that's sort of the end goal for all the Kalishtar. But you can pursue some other agenda, you know, fighting the Lords of Dust, or, you know, helping the dragons, or, you know, just being an inquisitive while trying to, like, just live well and hope that that also fights the Dreaming Dark. Either approach works in a game.
They're also a great race to play if you would like to be in the world, but not of the world. Kalishtar are always kind of removed from the other races of Corvair, except for other Kalishtar. Mostly because, like, Corvair isn't really your home. And you might not even be welcome in certain places in Corvair.
Yeah, like, and even if you're playing a game in Sarlona or, like, in Adar, like, Eberron is not really your home, right? But neither is Dalkor. Like, you are a dual natured being of both, like, mortal and immortal form. You don't really belong anywhere. You're always an outsider.
Kalishtar are also particularly strong willed in combat. So whether you fight melee or you're a spellcaster, you will have a formidable mind. That also means that Kalishtar are great if you want to be psionic. They are the best way to start as a telepath.
Also, if you want to play a monk, Kalishtar are a great option, especially if you are in the kind of game where you've got a GM who just, like, doesn't really like the monk class or doesn't really understand how it fits with their vision of the setting. Kalishtar are specifically from a far-off place, and they do the whole monk thing because they're trying to keep this dual-natured spirit within them contained. So it makes sense why they seem a little weird, they seem a little off-putting, but there's a reason why they're here in your medieval fantasy setting. All right, so let's talk a bit about their physiology. And as we say every time we do an installment in this series, when we talk about, like, what a Kalishtar is or what you might do, we're of course speaking in generalities. Your particular player character might be very different. So think about, you know, we're going to be talking about what the average sort of, like, baseline Kalishtar does. Think about, are you normal? Are you average in that way? Or are you abnormal? Are you very different from everyone else?
So Kalishtar physiology are basically human in form. The main difference between humans and Kalishtar is in the mind and soul. And it's also important to note that the Quarry spirit is not possessing a Kalishtar. They were mixed when the Adaran monks bonded thousands of years ago. They can't be separated. Like, one side doesn't control the other. They're, like, truly merged. So the Kalishtar don't see their spirit as, like, a separate entity. They see it as themselves.
Now, this makes them more resistant to attacks that target the mind. Maybe that's a possession or charms or trickery. It also makes them more resistant to things like psychic damage. Now, in your game, you kind of want to think about, what does it mean to be resistant to psychic damage? Okay, sure, it means that you take less damage from certain kinds of magical attacks. But I would think in a setting like Eberron, if you fought in the last war, which is very likely, maybe you're more resistant to things like PTSD. You know, like, a Kalishtar mind is less likely to break, but it is probably more likely to bend, maybe in alien kind of ways.
Yeah, also, like, just setbacks, right? Like, I feel like there's a lot of times in campaigns where the party has a big setback and the characters are reeling. The Kalishtar doesn't do that. You know, like, they're the ones who can endure that kind of distress.
Yeah, it's important to remember that this spirit that you have been bonded with is immortal. It's been around for at least 40,000 years. Like, it has these memories that stretch back. Since you were a baby, you have had memories of things that happened in far-off places a long time ago. You're sort of like born literally an old soul, you know? Kalistar should sort of seem like they are wise beyond their years. Also, a weird side effect of being bonded with a spirit from Dalkor is that they don't dream. So in order for the human bodies to be a safe place for the rebel spirits, the monks had to cut themselves off from dreams. So Kalistar don't dream. Sleep is instead a time when memories of the spirit's life resurface. So there's no chance to order the mind, you know, what humans do when they sleep. So that has to happen while they're awake, through meditation or through combat training. It also means that Kalistar are a bit more prone to madness than like normal humans. They just don't have that time to really get their mental affairs in order. And so if their training is interrupted or they just haven't had enough sort of downtime to focus themselves, things can get out of hand.
So then in terms of culture, Kalistar tend to live in small and close-knit communities. They're always concerned about their war against the Dreaming Dark, right? So they have to keep a low profile and avoid drawing undue attention to the group. They lean on each other in order to keep each other safe.
Yeah, and because they're always essentially at war or like prepping for war, you know, you never know when the Dreaming Dark could attack. Every action tends to have a purpose. You know, they have an undeserved reputation for asceticism. It's not that Kalistar don't drink or, you know, get inebriated. It's just that you'll rarely see one who's incapacitated because if you do that, you tend to get assassinated. But Kalistar themselves don't really see anything wrong with pleasure as long as it's not distracting them from watching their own backs.
Right. Also, they leverage telepathic communication.
Yeah, I think that probably makes bonds very close. I bet there's less misunderstanding between a Kalistar who are close to one another because you can use not only words and song, but telepathic communication, telepathic imagery.
Yeah, but in terms of relating with outsiders, you might have lower emotional intelligence because telepathy is kind of a cheat for emotion, right? Like, you just get it. So having to interpret that from a conversation from an outsider might be more difficult.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Kalistar can telepathically communicate with other creatures too, even if those creatures aren't telepathic. But I bet like one who's kind of new at it is probably almost like sending a cacophony of images into someone else's brain. You know, because they don't really know how to regulate it. Because like, I don't really know how to talk to someone who doesn't know how to process this stuff all the time.
Right. Or sometimes, you know, Kalistar can't use telepathy because that would be dangerous or revealing or whatever, right?
Yeah, you got to now, like, I'm undercover, right? If I use telepathy, it's pretty obvious right. Who I am. Now I have to rely on these words. It's so clumsy, this kind of communication. So Kalistar names specifically, speaking of keeping a low profile, honestly, like, the names never make any sense to me because it's so obvious that you're a Kalistar.
Mm-hmm.
The Kori spirit's name is appended to the end of the mortal name as a suffix. So Lanharath is a Kalistar name. That is Lan, the human, who is bonded with the spirit Harath. He has a brother, Malharath. Every Kalistar name is going to have sort of two parts.
Yeah, it's basically they only need one name. Their last name is just their spirit name, which means if you run into somebody with that name, they're a Kalistar. They should be killed by the Dreaming Dark.
Or, hey, we have the same, like, last half of our names. We know each other. We like, share part of the same soul.
Right. So, Kalistar society, like, the broad Kalistar society, is primarily, you know, monks living in Adar and not usually outgoing, adventuring Kalistar.
You got this other group of them who follow the Path of Light. And that's Kalistar who are trying to bring about this new age in Dalkor through right living and meditation. They are probably the ones who are living in, you know, smaller enclaves, just sort of doing like the regular actions that keep a community going, you know, living relatively normal lives. They might be adventurers, who might be, you know, things like clerics or maybe like low-level scions, they're probably not super combat-oriented.
And then in contrast, the Path of Shadows is the more combat-oriented. They are psychic warriors, they are monks, they are scions or soul blades. They're basically waging war on the front line against the Dreaming Dark.
Yeah, this is your sort of like prototypical Kalishdar adventurer. Like, okay, I'm with this party. They may not all be Kalishdar. We're sort of pursuing larger goals or making the world a better place. Or I'm, you know, trying to collect information for my own particular task. But if I get information about like a secret reagent, okay, I'm going to leverage the rest of the party and we're going to go conduct an assassination. In terms of religion, Kalishdar follow the Path of Light. It is sort of akin to the Arenal Elves and the Undying Court. It's sort of like this single entity that they worship. It's really more of a philosophy than a religion, but it is good and noble and lawful. The Rebel Quarry who escaped were those kinds of spirits. They left Dalkor specifically because the spirits in Dalkor are like evil and corrupting and chaotic. You know, Il-Lashtivar is, according to legend, the third incarnation of the spirit of Dalkor, and it's an evil one. So the Path of Light teaches that one of these days, and no one really knows when or why or how exactly, the age will turn, all Quarry will be destroyed, along with all the Quarry who are inhabiting Kalishdar, and a new spirit of Dalkor will form, and this one will be good. So all Kalishdar efforts are toward bringing this revolution about, and all of the Dreaming Dark efforts and therefore Re'adrin efforts are geared toward preventing it from happening.
So in terms of family, Kalishdar families tend to be very, very close because you use telepathy to bond with those around you. And there's two types of Kalishdar families. You have blood relations as well as Quarry lines. So the way that those lines are passed, spirits are passed down based on the gender of a parent. So a male child will inherit their father's spirit. A female child will inherit their mother's spirit. So two brothers will always have the same spirit, likely the same as like their uncle or a cousin, but they'll never have their mother or sister in the same spirit house.
This sort of leads to an interesting phenomenon among Kalishdar, and it was called a bit in Wayfinders, which I really liked, in that Kalishdar, both individually and as a society, are pretty gender fluid, because each Quarry, each immortal spirit, has its own gender identity, male or female, but that doesn't necessarily have to match the mortal body that that spirit bonded with. So, like, canonically, Teratai, who was the leader of the Rebel Quarry, was female, but she bonded with a male monk, which meant that, because of the way that spirits are passed down, every single member of Teratai's line was actually male with a female spirit. So you get into this interesting situation where it's not a weird thing for an individual Kalishdar to like present as one sex and but have part of their soul identify as a different one. And in fact, it would be really weird, or maybe even impossible, or other Kalishdar might view it as impossible for example, you to see a female with who is part of the Teratai line, even though both of them match in terms of gender identity. So I think you get into this cool situation where it's not really canonical, but you can see how depending on how you decide. Like the spirits sort of get passed down from line to line. There's a lot of options available for the way that like Kalishdar might view something like gender identity. Like I think it would be really interesting to, for example, have a character who's like a trans man, so born physically female but identifies as a man, but has a male spirit, like inherited a spirit from their father. And I think you can sort of go two ways with that. One, it might be very confusing to the Kalishdar because like, why, how could a female body inherit a spirit from the male. It also could be just be very obvious from birth to the Kalashtar that, like, yes, you have a female body, but you're obviously a man. Like, you inherited a spirit from your father. The spirit knows who you actually are. Like, your soul, because souls exist in everyone, like, your soul is male. That's why you got this particular spirit. It might just be like, well, duh, obviously we can all tell.
Right. So in terms of interactions, Kalashtar obviously have a close bond to other Kalashtar, right? Like, you are each an important, like, combatant in the fight against the Dreaming Dark. So almost by definition, like, any Kalashtar you meet is an ally. And if you are somehow forced into conflict, you know, because of competing points of view or whatever, you would have to do pretty much everything to prevent killing them. Like, you don't want to weaken your side in the fight.
Yeah, like, even if they're not helping you, they serve as a vessel for the spirit. And, you know, Teritai is gone. There are only 66 lines left. And there's no way to get them back. You know, you're not going to get any more Rebel Quarry from Dalkor. Like, you have it's a finite resource.
Yeah. And you are also prone to meeting either your own long-lost relatives or, you know, relations of people you might meet simply because, you know, there are so few spirit lines. Like, you are likely meeting somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody.
Yeah, or you could run into a stranger, technically, right? You have no idea who this person is, but you share the same Quarry line. So, I mean, you're basically siblings, you know?
Right. Then, of course, the flip side of that is the Inspired, the agents of the Dreaming Dark. Like, they're your mortal enemies. So, in the same way you would do anything to avoid killing a Kalashtar, you would do pretty much anything to kill or neutralize an Inspired, if it were at all possible.
Yeah, I think this is a nice opportunity for GMs to introduce tension into the game. There are lots of ambassadors from Riedra in many different nations, or really every nation in Corvair. What happens if they meet your Kalashtar character? They each probably knows who the other is or what the other is, right? And each absolutely wants to kill the other. But they probably can't right here in the middle of this court, because that guy's a diplomat. And this person is the citizen of a different nation. So, I don't know. Do we sneak around and stab each other in the dark? Are we very, very polite to each other, but just seething? Or are we communicating telepathically?
Yeah. Are you sending each other death notes? Like, with your mind?
Greetings, good sir. It is so very nice to meet a fellow countryman. I'm going to stab you in the soul.
With other races, of course, it's a much more detached kind of connection. You know, there is such a requirement for Kalashtar to meditate and maintain control in order to keep their dual soul in check that Kalashtar often just appear either haughty or distant or detached to non-Kalashtar. And I think as part of their kind of approach to fighting the Dreaming Dark, and also, like, in following the Path of Light, like, it's important for them to be kind and generous to the innocent, which means they are sometimes forced into difficult choices, right? Like, do you try to win a battle or fight the war in the long term, right? And likewise, as you're fighting your war against the Inspired and against the Dreaming Dark, like, what is the collateral damage to the innocent people around you who have no dog in that hunt?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about Burn Notice a lot, but this feels a lot to me like, you know, Michael Weston, who is in Miami, but not of Miami, if you will.
I don't know. He's pretty CIA, of you know? Miami. Yeah. He never sweats in his suit. He's pretty of Miami.
All right, fine. He's got the sunglasses, yes, and the other sunglasses. But yeah, like, they're very skilled, but they're also, like, good and good-natured. They want to help people. And you see that they get into these situations where, okay, Michael wants to find out who burned him, and, like, I'm just about to get that. You know, this is the war that I'm fighting. But it's going to hurt, like, this random person I met yesterday who, like, I told I would help. And so do I, like, sort of shoot myself in the foot to help this person? Yeah, I probably do. Let's be honest. Oh,
it's not even somebody that like Michael said he would help. It was somebody that like Sam or Jesse or Fiona said Michael would help.
Right. Like someone bought Sam a beer and now we're beholden to them for an episode and a half.
Right.
But, you know, every once in a while near the end of the season, like there would be probably someone who suffered collateral damage. I mean, usually it was like Fiona and Sam, you know, because Michael just like had to fight his war.
Yeah. So we've made a lot of reasons that Kalishtar would not be members of an adventuring party because it turns out they've got a lot going on. But what are some reasons that Kalishtar would be adventuring?
Well, you could just be following the path of light. You know, creating good in the world, ending evil where you see it. All of those actions, according to your religion, hasten the turning of the age. They hasten the coming of whatever this new good spirit is in Dalkor. So, great. You're out and helping people and, you know, making some money and getting some experience so you could be better at fighting the Dreaming Dark. It's all good.
Your adventuring could also be directly, you know, fighting the Dreaming Dark, right? Like, there are plenty of adventuring groups that either by direct intent or secondary intent are combating the Dreaming Dark. So hitching a ride with one of them certainly doesn't undermine your greater purpose.
Yeah, the Dreaming Dark could very easily be the big bad of your campaign. You know, they are a big, multi-continental evil organization with lots of power and the ability to conduct subterfuge, and they're likely plotting coups in multiple nations. Like, and they should be defeated.
And they very well could have pulled off the Day of Mourning, whatever the Day of Mourning actually was.
Oh, absolutely. That's 100% right.
Of course, Kalishtar, being as they have to keep that low profile and are locked into a war for their very existence, often find themselves on the run. And it turns out if you've got to run from a multinational evil organization, then it tends to be easier to run if you're running with four or six other people that are capable of defending themselves and you.
Right.
So like, yeah, hey, I'll go raid this tomb with you for magic items. Don't let me get killed in my sleep, please. That would be great.
Hey, four other 15th level characters who are essentially the equivalent of an army battalion each. Great. It could actually be something much more quiet or internal. You could be on a journey to discover yourself because Kalishtar have this dual nature. So much of who you actually are is alien to your physical form. There's a part of you that's been alive for thousands of years and will exist, hopefully, for thousands of years after you die. How do you reconcile those two things? What does it really mean to be you? Like, what is you? Who are you? That's something that you can really explore and investigate while, you know, traipsing around, solving problems and fighting monsters.
It's also possible that you're adventuring because you have lost control. And while it seems unlikely that Kalishtar would maybe cast one of their own out, perhaps you have sort of imposed this as a safety precaution on yourself, right? If you, if you're a wild magic sorcerer who can't fully control her emotions, then perhaps you have said that I need to go be separate from our community so that I do not become a liability to more than myself.
Oh, that totally seems like what a lawful good wilder would do, right? I gotta leave. This is no good for you. So in terms of classes, I really like the design of this particular race because those are the stats. You get plus one to wisdom, plus one to charisma, and then plus one to an ability score of your choice, which could be wisdom or charisma. So if you want, you can have plus two wisdom. You could also have plus two charisma, or you could just have one to three stats, which is really great for a lot of these multiple ability dependent builds. Mm-hmm. It's much better than something like Triton, which like forces you to get plus one to three different stats, which may not even be the stats you necessarily want.
Right.
So you make a great sorcerer. You can have plus two to charisma, and it's a really good match for a Kalishtar Scion. Because if you think about it, like Scion is typically intelligence based. We don't know what it's going to be. I have a feeling it will be when we get final rules for it. But a Kalishtar is really like casting from the power of their soul, right? Within, not necessarily from like learning from books.
Paladin and Bard also make a lot of sense because of that plus two charisma or, you know, the ability to add charisma and another stat. Like, you can get your strength or your dex up to assist as well. And then, of course, Paladin being lawfully aligned, that's kind of a natural landing place for a Kalishtar.
Yeah, your whole life is a crusade.
Right. And then a Bard, on the other hand, right, like, you get to take advantage of all of your mental capabilities and sort of your strong mind and sort of that natural leadership fitting into that sort of group dynamic.
And, of course, with high charisma, Warlock works really well. And I really like any of the patrons to stand in for your spirit, whereas, like, the Quarry wouldn't be a separate patron that you talk to. It reflects the additional abilities that you're getting because of your, you know, strong soul and this bond with this, you know, this immortal spirit that goes back thousands of years.
Yeah. And then, of course, on the wisdom side, Druid and Cleric are the natural fits. Well, Druid, Cleric, and Monk are the natural fits. All of those work pretty well. Though I think Druid is probably the least natural of them, just because mm-hmm. Druids don't typically have a particularly lawful bent, and also tend to be more connected to nature than they are to sort of humanity, or at least like sentient life. So that's a little bit of a stretch for Kalishtar.
Yeah, it's interesting. The wisdom-based classes, the stats work for Druid, but like personality-wise, I think it would be quite rare. And I think that Kalishtar healers are probably more likely to be bards than clerics. So if you are a druid or a cleric, just sort of ask yourself, what is it that sort of drew you to this strange occupation?
Oh, come on. Path of Light, Cleric of Light. What's the difference?
Path of Light, by that it means fire in your face.
So in combat, Kalishtar tend to be pretty effective, very tactical, and rather cautious. They know that they're losing their life is a great loss to their entire race.
Yeah, and, you know, they control themselves. Why wouldn't they be controlling the situation or the battlefield? They tend not to be cruel. They're often willing to give quarter, although I think it's important to remember who you're fighting against. If it's an agent of the Dreaming Dark, and especially if you're fighting against an inspired or even like a manifested evil quarry in like physical form, I think it's very likely you might be vicious. Like, absolutely no mercy given, and like going for the killing blow right away.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know that they would necessarily feel that way against agents of the Dreaming Dark, but definitely against inspired, right? Like, but the Dreaming Dark could just hire assassins from anywhere, right? Like, they don't necessarily have to be inspired to be assassins of Kalishtar. So I think they might offer quarter to hired hands that they wouldn't necessarily offer to, like, inducted members.
Oh, just wait till we get our character ideas for the Mindhunter, okay? No quarter asked, no quarter given, probably.
So in terms of skills, the Kalishtar get to choose either insight, intimidation, performance, or persuasion and just get automatic advantage on it, which is pretty powerful.
Yeah, I like, mechanically speaking, that this is something that stacks with a lot of other ways to sort of bump up your skill check. Sure, you can't use the help action, but that's fine. You're kind of getting an automatic help action from your own soul, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's pretty crazy that a bard or even just a rogue with expertise and persuasion is also granting themselves advantage.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. The gambler. Do we need to revisit the gambler?
Oh, yeah. The gambler is definitely a Kalishtar, I think. I think rerolling a die is less powerful than that. So, Ishan, have you ever played a Kalishtar?
I actually haven't, but they're really high on my list. And yeah, I know a couple of other people who've been talking to me about like possible ideas for a Kalishtar character.
Yeah, I think we didn't choose Kalishtar, in the Morning Glory campaign, so they weren't heavily featured. But as we talk about going back to Eberron and playing in, like, you know, a Morning Glory adjacent campaign, I think that is a big unexplored area that if I don't play in, I hope that somebody in our group does. Because I think, like, they just make such... their natural story has such a great big bad in the Dreaming Dark. Like, it would be a shame to leave that plot hook just sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah, I really like how... I think it happens to all of us. You have this character and, you know, you're into the storyline that's happening, but you're just sort of looking at your character and going, I'm not exactly sure why they, like, are motivated to do a thing or leave a thing or to follow a particular thread. And Kalashtar, well, there's always something for the GM to sort of push you along or chase you or dangle in front of you to pursue. Like, unless you've destroyed the Dreaming Dark, you have a goal.
Right, yeah. Like, does this thing in some way tangentially hurt the Dreaming Dark? Cool, I'm all in. Say no more.
I'm a lazy Kalashtar. Doesn't matter, they're coming for me. I gotta run.
Right. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
It wasn't the proper knock here on the Enclave door, which means we've been found out.
Well, then we better roll up some new characters because the Dreaming Dark is going to get us. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's Malice minus Meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And here is a word from the newbie DM, Minicast.
All right, so my bosses James Intercast and Rudy Basso asked me to record a commercial for the newbie DM Minicast, my new 5 to 10 minute podcast aimed at giving dungeon masters quick nuggets of advice. But I've never cut a commercial before, so let me see what I could do. Best radio voice. All right, newbie DM here inviting you. Oh wow, that's terrible. Hello, newbie DM here inviting you to join the Minicast. Wow, that's bad. This sucks. I'm never going to get this commercial for the newbie DM Minicast done, and James and Rudy are going to be mad at me. Well, you know what? Let me just put this aside for now and get back to recording another episode of the Minicast, where I give out some hot DMing advice, and I'll come back to the commercial later. Sorry, James. Sorry, Rudy. It's not going to happen right now.
And we're back. So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we're building the Mind Hunter, a psychic tracker who makes excellent use of divination abilities to make sure that no quarry ever gets away. Get it? Quarry?
Okay. So what is the build?
It is Divination Wizard 9, Shadow Sorcerer 8, Paladin 2, Hexblade Warlock 1.
Okay, good. This is going to be a fun one to update the codex for, but let's get started. Wizard, 9th level, that gets us 5th level spells. And as a divination wizard, we're going to get the expert divination ability at level 6 to regain a lower level spell slot.
Yeah, when you cast a divination spell, you can regain a slot lower than the slot you just expended up to 5th level. Now, normally, in the past, this hasn't really done that much. Like, okay, you cast, Arcane Eye, and then later you can cast See Invisibility. Woo. But with the advent of Xanathar's, we have the second level spell, Mind Spike, which actually does damage. Hey! And you can upcast the spell up to, you know, 5th level, and then regain a 4th level slot. And then next round, cast it at 4th level and regain a 3rd level slot, etc., etc. You can essentially, at will, Mind Spike. You never run out of these high-level damaging spells.
Yeah.
Now, since you regain a slot, just make sure that you have expended low-level spell slots first. This usually isn't difficult. You know, you're always going to, like, use a shield or an absorb elements, something like that. You got a lot of, like, 2nd and 3rd level utility spells that you sort of want to use just so you have 1 to 2 available slots that you can regain, so you're not, you know, missing out on this.
Yeah, and then it also, I mean, that ability just generally gives you a chance to use your utility spells without paying the heavy cost of other non-divination combat spells, right? So things like See Invisibility or Tongues, Arcane Eye, Detect Thought, like things that don't have a huge use in combat necessarily. See invisibility obviously does. But you can use those spells without the risk of like reducing your combat capability later on in the rest period.
Yeah, and these are actually great spells to sort of toss out of the way because many of them last so long and they don't require concentration. So like, sure, I may as well see invisibility for an hour. Why not? I'm going to get that slot back anyway. So from Sorcerer, obviously you're following the Path of Shadows. You're going to get a neat little save versus death ability one time per day at first level. You'll get up to fourth level spells, and you'll get sorcery points, which can be used in a variety of ways.
Yep, you can always eat your lower level spell slots to gain sorcery points, to create higher level spell slots for Mind Spike, to then regain those lower level slots back.
Yeah, because you can't really do anything with those first level slots because there's not like a damaging first level divination spell to cast and you're not going to get regain a slot anyway. So you just end up with like all these first level slots that you just upcycle.
You can also spend sorcery points to give yourself dark vision. And then, of course, you get meta magic. So Quicken Spell, Twin Spell, couple of the most powerful options in the game.
Yeah, Twin is really nice on Mind Spike, of course, because it's doubling your damage and, you know, hitting multiple targets. So, you know, you spend those, you basically waterfall down to a bunch of first level slots. You turn them into sorcery points. You then quicken a high level Mind Spike and just begin the entire cascade all over again.
Right. So the Shadow Sorcerer also gets a pet in the form of the Hound of Ill Omen.
Yeah, pretty hard to hide from a dog that always knows your location.
Then, of course, we've got two levels of Paladin, which means we are chasing Smite.
Hey, it's something else to do with all those first level spell slots. You don't want to turn them into sorcery points? That's fine. Just turn them into damage.
Yeah, throw a couple extra D8s on there. And then from Warlock, we'll take Hexblade so that we can use Charisma as our attack statistic, meaning we don't pay any penalty for being in combat.
And I think in addition, just make sure you pick up maybe Green Flame Blade or Booming Blade because you're only getting that one attack. So you just want to stack as much as you can on it.
So what would you do in terms of leveling order?
I think I would probably actually start Hexblade. And reflavor the patron as, you know, my quarry spirit because, you know, Hexblade 1 is strong. You've got attack and damage all out of your charisma. And then from there, I would start going probably Wizard 6 to get Mind Spike going. Shadow Sorcerer 3 so that I've got Mana Magic points, Paladin 2, and then I'd finish out Wizard and then Sorcerer.
So, Ishin, who is your Mind Hunter?
So, like I said before, my Mind Hunter asks for and gives no quarter. She would be a Vengeance Paladin if she made it that far, but she got a bit distracted with stabbing people in the brain with her own brain. She is a member of an elite Kalishtar cell in Corvair, who has been raised to follow the Path of Shadows. And she knows that her purpose is to locate members of the Dreaming Dark or the Inspired Reagent Ambassadors, whomever, and eliminate them without prejudice. She finds them, she hunts them down, and she kills them, often by creating a mind blade or a soul blade in her hands. Sometimes it takes the form of a melee weapon, sometimes it, you know, a packed weapon, perhaps, or something akin. Sometimes it's just a, you know, a ranged projectile of pure energy that she, you know, hurls with her hand. Maybe it ends up being invisible. Perhaps she just fires mind bullets. But in any case, they're always deadly. She always finds her mark and drives the spike home, if you will. What about your Mind Hunter?
So my Mind Hunter is similar in the sense that he is going to be chasing down a lot of the Inspired and gaining revenge on the Dreaming Dark, or at least carrying out the war on the Dreaming Dark. But my poor Kalishtar, he's not in it for the greater good. He's not fighting that huge battle against the Dreaming Dark. He is just out for vengeance because his enclave of Kalishtar was massacred when he was just a boy. And he's the sole survivor. And he became a warlock very close to that moment because he communes with the dead spirits of the Kalishtar that he was raised by. Given that he had no Kalishtar monks to raise him in the path of light, he has no training as a monk. He was too young for any of that. He kind of had to find his own path, and it meanders quite a bit, right? But he is singular in his mission to exact his vengeance upon every single member of the Dreaming Dark who was responsible for the death of his family and his community. And any other members of the Dreaming Dark who want to stand in his way, he is happy to cut them down as well.
So wait, so how old was he when this happened? Does he even know his name? Like his Kalishtar name?
No, probably not. Like I'm feeling like he was probably like 10 or 11, right? Like probably prepubescent because Shadow Sorcerer hasn't quite like developed yet because that's a later level. So that, once again, I'm playing a child. Or more likely not playing this character until we start at a higher level.
Yeah, I like this idea that it could even be that like he doesn't even really know he's a Kalishtar, or like what he is, you know? He knows he has visions of crazy far off places and weird dreams, but you know, so do a lot of kids with trauma.
Yeah, I mean, he might actually be like totally passing in society as a human.
But, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, totally.
You know, a human warlock, I guess, as much as that passes.
A 10-year-old who occasionally creates weapons out of thin air.
Right. All right. Before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
You can also leave us an iTunes review. If you leave us a 5-star review, that helps other people find the show, and we will read it on the air. So this week, I am reading More Smart Than Funny, But Still a Lot of Fun, 5 stars by Bill Byrne. Bill writes, I hate iTunes, but your podcast is worth it. Great format, funny without being dumb, one of the best D&D podcasts.
Without being dumb? It's high praise. I'm surprised.
I mean, there is no higher praise than somebody who didn't already have iTunes being willing to get iTunes to leave a review.
I still haven't.
iTunes is the literal worst.
But you should definitely log in and give us a review.
Once. All right, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about post-apocalyptic games.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building Furiosa.
I believe it's Furiosa.
Of course, sorry.
That's it for episode 164 of Total Party Thrill, but I hope we've lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
Furiosa. And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening. I like when we make ourselves chuckle.